Now let's consider Adam Smith in Book 1, Chapter 11 of The Wealth of Nations on the Rent of Land. This chapter is entitled, Of the Rent of Land. There's a lot of detail in this chapter about particular instances of land rents, but I'd like to hone in on one very particular question, and that is the analytic distinction between neoclassical and classical theories of land. Smith here, of course, representing the classical theories pretty clearly. Let's imagine that we have three plots of land, and the first plot of land is yielding, say, 10. The second plot of land is yielding, say, 7. And the third plot of land is yielding, say, 3, just for purposes of argument. The neoclassical approach would be to say that it's the value of land at the margin which is going to set the market price or the rent for the land. So in this case, if you think of the three parcels of land being used, that value at the margin is here represented by 3, and the rent of land will be 3. The rent of land is not given, say, by 10, any more than the price of water in the marketplace is given by how valuable the first sip of water might be if you were dying of thirst, but rather the price of water is set by the marginal unit with supply and demand coming together, just as we would find for the price of land. In contrast, the classical approach to rent would be very different indeed. So a typical classical approach would be to find some level of output from the land which suffices to support labor and yield a fair return to capital. So let's say, for instance, that level were 2, and we would draw a line across here, 2, and we would have payments of 2 going to labor and also to capital. And then in the classical approach, the rent of land is the difference between 2 and what each piece of land yields. So this piece of rent here would have, this piece of land here would have a rent of 1. This piece of land here would have a rent of 7 minus 2. That would be 5. And this piece of land here would have 10 minus 2, and that would have a rent of 8. So there would be differential rent. And rent here is given by how much does each piece of land yield minus what is required to support labor and capital on that land. One way to think about the classical theory is to imagine it being based on something like the following assumptions. The first would be just that the landowner has basically the monopoly power, and that in any bargaining struggle, well, the landowner will do better than, say, labor or capital, that it's land which is truly scarce. Another relevant underlying implicit assumption would be simply that different pieces of land don't compete with each other very much, that the model is thinking of each piece of land as somewhat being standalone, and it's not a question of an entrepreneur deciding to use this parcel of land or that parcel of land, but rather there's some land and that land is locked in a bargaining struggle with some capital and labor, and that land is likely to win the bargaining struggle. Another underlying implicit assumption is simply that labor is in quite elastic supply, so that if a landowner decides not to work with some laborers, well, there are always other laborers who will come along and work that land. To be clear, I'm not suggesting that Smith or the other classical economists ever laid out these assumptions. I don't think you'll find that to be true. It's just a way of thinking of, in the models that we're used to using, neoclassical economics, how might you modify neoclassical assumptions to get something closer to classical results? Now, the neoclassical assumptions concerning rent and land will be somewhat different. The first would be simply that bargaining power is not all that important. The neoclassical model does not have to assume that bargaining power is equal, but that most of the rent of land in neoclassical models is typically not determined by relative bargaining strengths. The neoclassical model also thinks of different pieces of land of coexisting along a spectrum of marginal uses of declining value, and that entrepreneurs are basically choosing one piece of land rather than another, and there really is a generalized market for land, where land has to compete to be taken up, just like all the other factors of production. So basically, in the neoclassical model, you can think of the factors as symmetric, and that land, capital, and labor are all being hired by entrepreneurs. And just as in the classical model, labor can be highly elastic in supply, well, in neoclassical models, land can be, it doesn't have to be, but land may be elastic in supply as well. And this will mean there's no necessary market power for land. And the way that land works in the model is quite a bit like how labor works. That's in neoclassical models. But again, as stated, classical models will be quite different. Anyway, that's how I might reconcile this chapter of Smith's with what we learn from neoclassical economics. Because reading it as a neoclassical economist, a lot of the argumentation appears to be quite strange. But this is a very fundamental and underlying difference between classical and neoclassical models, and analytically speaking, it's very important to be clear on where exactly these classical results are coming from, and this is my attempt to put them in the form of some basic differences in underlying assumptions. There's a lot of historical and also institutional detail in this chapter. Smith makes two other analytic points. One is simply that the presence of positive rent on land follows from the economics of food production, namely that with a piece of land, it's possible to produce more food with that land than is required to support the labor needed to help produce that food. Smith also argues that this presence or existence of a generally positive land rent will in most cases set a generally positive rent for all land, whether or not that land is being used for agriculture. Note also, I'm only covering part of this chapter on land. The chapter closes with a very lengthy discussion of silver and silver mines and silver prices called Digression on Silver, and I'll be getting to that immediately in the next video.